Good evening and welcome to the Healthy Debate. My name is Lindy Naughton. Our aim with this programme, produced by Health Freedom Ireland in conjunction with the Irish Inquiry, is to promote debate on issues relating to health in Ireland. We would like to emphasise that we have no agenda beyond seeking to present all sides of the argument so that you, the public, can make up your own minds on how to manage your lives. Much of the material you see on this programme is not available on mainstream channels, so if you wish to support us and to spread the word, please press share on your screens now. I'm not quite sure where it is, but press it anyway. So what's been happening? Well, the peaceful assembly in Cork, we're using our words carefully here, last Sunday went off well, with no recurrence of the heavy-handed tactics seen in Dublin a week earlier. Well done to all concerned, and we'll have words with the organiser towards the end of this programme. Numbers of virus cases are dropping steadily, as they always do at this time of the year. It looks as if we're almost out of this crisis. Now, all we want is for our politicians to catch up with us and realise this fact. What a happy day it will be for us all when they discharge Neffet. One interesting sign that matters are moving on is the change in the way the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, or HPSC, to put it briefly, is presenting its COVID statistics. They seem to have abandoned their weekly reports, although the fortnightly summaries are still being published. Missing from these, however, are the statistics for the numbers of people who were previously ill when they were diagnosed with COVID. In mid-February, when last recorded, that figure was 683 of the claimed 4,137 deaths associated with COVID. Even taking that larger number, by the way, only 0.09% of our population of 4.1 million have died from this supposedly lethal disease. And death rates overall are nothing unusual. Tonight's debate is on the economics of lockdown and what we can expect over the next few years. Our two guests have promised that they won't bamboozle us with jargon or bewilder us with incomprehensible statistics. They are Eddie Hobbs, who's on the screen there. Eddie is a specialist in personal finance, perhaps best known for the rip-off Republic and Show Me the Money programmes on RTE. I hope it was RTE. Mark O'Byrne, sitting beside me here in the studio, is an entrepreneur who has the great good fortune to also have a history degree, so he knows how to put facts in context. Mark has criticised in the strongest possible terms the impact of lockdowns on us all. He's also highly critical of the corrupt Irish financial system, which he sees as the root of many of our problems. For that reason, he trades in gold and silver, and why wouldn't you? So we're going to start by just looking generally at what's going on. So we'll ask Mark to look at the international scene and then Eddie to look at the national scene, if you would, please, in plain language, by the way. Right, so we'll start with you, Mark. What's happening internationally?
Yeah, well, thanks for the introduction. And it was a very good introduction. And you summed it up very well in terms of the wider context of what's going on in Ireland and the world, you know. We basically have a massive COVID scare, and they're using it for, I think, pre-designed agendas are coming to fruition, you know. So the bottom line is that the in terms of globally, we already had a massive global debt bubble, like astronomical. We're talking about 250 trillion. I know you don't want me using big numbers and all the rest, but I'm going to help people understand. Yeah, so it's a very, very big number. When I started out in 2003, we used to talk about millions, and a million was a lot of money. And then it was billions, and that was a lot of money. And then in recent years, we're talking about trillions. So a trillion is one with 12 zeros after it. So 0000000000000000.
Is that a billion?
No, it's a million, yeah, right. Or 1,000 billion. Yeah, but you're nearly there. So it's a huge number, and that number is now bandied around, and people don't realise the scale of it, you know. And then so people understand, so globally the debt is between, there's different institutions internationally have different figures for it, but it's roughly between 250 trillion and 300 trillion. So it's absolutely ginormous. And this is a gigantic monetary experiment. Basically, they're experimenting with the currency. We've never done this before in history, you know. And we used to print money, and it created huge issues. Now we're electronically creating on a keyboard. They just create trillions of dollars, euros, and pounds, you know. And it's not just dollars that is happening. It's happening in all the currencies, you know. So the debt in itself doesn't matter if the GDP is keeping up with the debt. But the GDP is actually obviously fallen not because of COVID, but because of the lockdowns and the government response has led to a massive contraction of all of our economies because they've shut us up and they shut down all the vital small to medium enterprises in all of our economies. These are the backbones of most economies in the world, whether it be Ireland, Germany, and it's very important even in America, you know. So the corporations are having a field day, you know. But the GDP last year, I think it was 80, global GDP was 85 trillion. So it's the debt is three times bigger than the global GDP. And what's global GDP for your listeners on Facebook and YouTube? So GDP, it's gross domestic product, and basically it's the trading of goods and services between every single member of the planet, all 8 billion of us. So all 8 billion of us in 1 year, we trade goods and services between us. And that comes to a value of just below 90 trillion. But the global debt is nearly 300 trillion. So it's nearly three times more. And you have a sovereign debt crisis, national debt crisis, as we've had in Ireland and many countries around the world in the 2008 to 2012 period, when national debt to GDP goes over 150, 200%. So this is, you know, it's a massive Ponzi scheme, and it's liable to collapse, unfortunately, you know.
Where is the debt held? I know that sounds like a really stupid question. What is debt? Do you know what I mean?
Basically, the form of money we have
bank?
Today is debt. So the central banks are just, you know, not even printing it. They're electronically creating trillions and trillions. So who holds the debt? I mean, institutions hold the debt, pension funds. You know, all of us who have pensions tend to be in portfolios of equities and bonds. But the biggest holders are actually the banks themselves because they've been buying a lot of this debt in quantitative easing. They electronically create the currency and then they buy the bonds, you know. But what's happening now, and we all forgave that in 2008, 2009, 2010, because, you know, the risk was the financial system was going to collapse. All the sovereigns were under pressure and the governments were going to go bankrupt. So the central bank said, right, we'll print money or electronically create money to buy the bonds in order to keep the interest rates low. So we all accepted that as a sort of a Faustian bargain, a short-term solution. But many of us warned at the time, including Eddie and myself, that this would not be a short-term solution. This would likely go on. And, you know, QE1 became QE2 and QE3. So I've given the global context, but the US alone in the last year has done $8 trillion worth of QE just in this last 12 months. And now they used to print the money or create the money just to buy US treasuries, which are considered very safe bonds throughout history. US treasuries are considered, along with gold, two of the safest assets in the world. And now they're actually buying junk bonds. They're buying corporate bonds, so the bonds of companies, but not just the best of companies, some of the worst of companies. The junk bonds have been bought. They're buying stocks. They're buying ETFs. Companies like Hertz Rent-A-Car, a rent-a-car company, why are they supporting this? So they're basically realizing the whole system is now vulnerable and they're having to support it artificially. It's on a life support machine in effect, you know. But the net result of this is that the currencies are going to be massively debased, and we've seen that throughout history. We're just going to see a new form of currency debasement. And when you debase a currency, basically you create too much of it, and then the value is diluted.
Well, like
that's it in a nutshell.
Some of those African nations were...
Exactly, yeah.
Zimbabwe,
yeah, Argentina. Mm. But it was seen in Germany, obviously, as a classic example in 1918 after World War I. And they were one of the most advanced, sophisticated economies in the world, you know. And they lost the war, incurred huge debt. But arguably the debts today on a global scale are on a par with what was in Germany prior to their hyperinflation. So there are a lot of people now warning that hyperinflation is your real worst-case scenario when your currency gets completely wiped out. And that's a possibility, but more likely is stagflation, where we see contracting economic growth and significant inflation in the value, particularly of, I said to you this before, the show started, you see luxury goods that we don't need, like big cars, fancy cars, and has a lot of debt attached to it, you'll see deflation. But the like petrol in your car, food, water, the essentials of life, we're likely to see quite a bit of inflation. Yeah.
Right. So, Eddie, can you summarise what's going on nationally in this wonderful green isle of ours?
Well, firstly, you have to remember that the Irish economy really is part of the picture that Mark has presented. We're very open. We behave very much like an Asian tiger economy. In other words, we can grow very, very fast because we're so open to global growth. But we're also then open to the shocks, probably 1.5 times more than many other economies. I'm giving the positive first. We've a young population. We've plenty of room for growth. We've huge deficits in housing, as you know, and infrastructure that all has to be dealt with over the decade or so ahead. So we have a lot going for us. We've a young population, all of that kind of thing. So we can actually grow quite quickly. The great problem, as Mark has pointed out, is that really for over a decade, there has been a massive intervention in you want to call it capitalism. And the intervention has been by central banks. So central banks have come together and simply said that any time the global economy has shown any sign of sagging, think of it as a patient, Lindy. You'll find it easier to understand. We just give it a massive dose, another dose of steroids, massive dose of steroids. So that's what's happened again in COVID-19. This time the dose of steroids is just huge. It's about an amount of money equal to about a quarter of the entire global GDP created out of nothing in keyboards. That's the extent of the stimulus. So we're a bit like somebody who's about to go into the Olympics, thinking that we are a fully fit and ready athlete. When in point of fact, we're absolutely soaked in steroids. And we have been for a long time, and we feel good, but actually we're not. The global financial system is creaking under all of this massive amount of money printing. And the only way we're in a trap now in Ireland, because we are members of the Eurozone, the debt level is going to such a level now. Longer. Meanwhile, for the first time since 1973 to 1983 in Ireland, you're going to start seeing consumer prices rising, and probably towards the back end of this year, certainly into next year, because of the glut of capital created from all of the money printing. And now the counter argument that people make is that all of the excess kind of capacity in economies can be used to mop up all the increased pressure coming through from too much demand because too much money is being created. But I don't think that's going to happen this time around. That's a view that's becoming more widely shared, and that we are entering an inflationary cycle. Now, you might say, well, what's the big deal? Well, it's a very big deal for a lot of people who are relying on their savings to see them through. When they find that they lose maybe every year 3 or 4% permanently of their savings in real purchasing in purchasing power, and it's also a very big deal for people that are relying on pension funds, at people that are on fixed incomes in retirement, really big deal, and you know the truth is then that those that are managing all of this, politicians, asset managers, they're all part of the conventional groupthink on how all this is going to play out. And none of them, with the exception of those who are in their 80s now, has any memory at all of managing money, managing economies through a high inflationary cycle. It's all in textbooks, hasn't happened for so long, and that's where we're going. So I think that if I was to say to people listening, look, the one thing to take out of all of this is that Ireland is highly likely, despite all of the good things we've going for us, like every other economy, to enter into a high inflationary cycle at some stage over the next few years. And it's going to change everything. There's some positive changes if you're carrying a lot of debt, obviously. and you can manage your way through it. But really, it does mean that the currency itself, the paper currency we have, the euro, the dollar, all paper currencies are going to be severely tested. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, we have the World Economic Forum, comprised of the wealthiest companies in the world, all seeing this coming, knowing we're in a trap, and coming up with their formula on how we should run our lives, which is the Great Reset. It's not a conspiracy theory. You can actually go to the conspiracy theory on the website of the World Economic Forum, and you can read all about it. It's there. It's black and white. That's their formula. That's what they want to do. So this is where, you know, there's an attempt, really, I think, to reduce the impact of local democracies, bypass all of the chambers of democracy, and implement the views of this technocracy. NEFIT is a technocracy. In our case, it's part of the state intervention, bigger state, more intervention. And the World Economic Forum agenda really appears to thrive in the idea of lockdowns, because it might form part of its CO2 management challenge. But one way or the other, whatever way we do it, we're being told by the wealthiest nexus of power brokers really in the world how we should manage our affairs while they continue to do what they're doing. And that's the problem I have with the World Economic Forum. That's what got me into all of this. That's where I started doing my reading and found, to my shock, that they had been planning this for a long time, for 6 or 7 years. It's not just because of COVID. COVID is an opportunity to implement the agenda. Across then at the IMF, which is a huge impact. We're a member of the IMF. I mean, the IMF is what, you know, what people rely on when countries go burst. The IMF agenda is again focusing on a big pivot happening in global finance. And the head of the IMF, who's a Bulgarian PhD from before the destruction of the Iron Curtain, she's of the view that that we're at a Bretton Woods moment, which is, Mark will understand, and it's all happening again. It happened in 1946, and that we're going to have to reconstruct the global, a new type of global currency. So there is a big pivot coming, and it's coming in the area of currency.
I was just going to say, I was going to get onto that later about, I mean, the World Economic Forum to me is bizarre. It's like science fiction when you read it. And it's worth, if anybody's interested, it really is worth reading the history of it, which, as Eddie said, is available on their website. You just think, how on earth did this happen? So I'm going to ask the pair of you, how on earth did this? How have we ended up in a situation where governments seem to be able to loan? I mean, if you or I went to the bank and asked for the kind of money, we'd be told to get lost, and they'd be, you know, we'd be, have to pay a huge whack of interest. How has this happened? We'll go to Mark first.
Well, yeah, it's been happening for a long period of time. So this is
like long period meaning what?
Possibly since the end. No, I was going to say the end of the Second World War. No, I'd say probably 71. So Nixon 71. Went off the gold standard in 1971. And that was, Eddie mentioned Bretton Woods there.
Yeah.
So Bretton Woods was the monetary system that they set up after 1945, which basically was a form of a gold standard, a gold exchange standard, whereby the people weren't on the gold standard, the currencies weren't on the gold standard, but the nations, each nation's budgets would have to be balanced in gold. Yeah. So you'd have export surpluses, deficits, and they would settle every single year. And so in 71, Nixon said, we're not doing that anymore, which gave America what Guy Starr de Stang called an exorbitant privilege. And that allowed America to start living beyond their means. And they started consuming the world's resources, and their corporations became more and more powerful. It conferred quite a few advantages to them, you know. And basically they've lived way beyond their means for a long period of time. But that trajectory, they have long been so supporting corporations over the interests of the people, over communities, over small businesses. That's been the way in America for a long period of time, particularly since the 80s. I think it got accelerated. Yeah. You see this huge financialization. And in effect, we don't have capitalism anymore. We have a form of corporatocracy where the corporations basically run the show. The politicians are minions. And and now it's clear it's actually a form of, it's a technocratic feudalism that we have, whereby there's been almost a fusion of these large institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, even the EU to a degree. It's like they're all working hand in glove with the Amazons and the Facebooks and Google. And it's very, very dangerous, very anti-democratic, you know, and these Dallas elites, you know, these billionaires who have made an absolute fortune in these lockdowns, because they've shut down all the competition because they have the technology. They have the e-commerce platforms. So they made, I think, I think it's 10 of the richest men in the world. So 0.001% of the planet, or even less, they made $500 billion in the last 12 months. While the rest of us, the global GDP fell, and the rest of us lost a huge amount of money, and people lost their jobs and all the rest, you know. And Eddie's point about the people on fixed income, when inflation takes off, the people who own these assets, like these people, will be protected, because they have purchasing power in their businesses, and they own assets. They would own gold. They own land. A lot of these people are actually moving to buy land in a very big way, which is interesting. But the people who will suffer are the people on the fixed income. So the pensioners on the fixed income, and the unemployed, all these poor people on the COVID payments, you know, people giving out, all these people are on $350 a week for doing nothing, and it's like these people want, the vast majority of people want to work, obviously, you know, and the government has actually shut down all their businesses, taken away all their employment, taken away their livelihood, and basically destroyed the backbone of our economy, you know, in the interest of these large corporations, and that's what's happened, and people need to start waking up and acknowledging that fact.
I mean, from my own reading of economic history, the big change was, in fact, around 1980, where a decision, according to Thomas Piketty anyway, was made when the erosion of the ability of governments to demand tax from the wealthiest kind of really kicked in, that they stopped taxing rich people. I mean, that's just my naive way of looking at it.
I'd say that's a factor.
Do you know?
Yeah,
and
they haven't been paying their fair share for a long time.
I don't know, Eddie. With the what was the name of the chap who spoke to at Davos? You know, and was he just said we're not talking about the big issue here, which is none of you guys here who flew in your private planes are paying tax.
Hmm.
So you know, for ordinary people, how have these people been allowed to become so outrageously and obscenely wealthy?
Well, all history is a bristling with examples of how countries have always been taken over, consumed by the most powerful, because that's what they do unless you stop it from happening, and it's resisted. And that's just human nature. I mean, which it wasn't that way, but it is. You might say, well, how did it happen? Well, I mean, the most powerful country in the world, the United States of America, its government has been captive to the wealthiest people in America for a long, long time. And that's coming in over here. I mean, I would argue that the Conservative Party in Britain became captive to the same type of forces and thinking, which is really driven by the accumulation of power and wealth. But where we are today is that these organizations, this nexus of companies, it's not a conspiracy. It's not like a Hollywood conspiracy, right? It's just power and how it operates. But the nexus of technocracies really have got closer and closer together. Central banks printing money, creating extreme wealth for the extremely wealthy, the middle classes and working classes being bypassed. And now we're facing a huge wave of artificial intelligence coming in, which is going to remove the requirement to work, is going to generate a new underclass or useless class, I think was an awful term used to describe it. And that the response to that then will be, we're now going to shift to, or the proposal is we will shift to the idea that central banks will get much closer to big government and will simply print money and send it directly to consumers in the form of income benefit. In other words, this is going to be central bank dole, which they've been dishing out to national governments and corporations, which Mark discussed for the last decade and longer, is actually going to be dished out to consumers. It's called modern monetary theory. So instead of controlling it by increasing interest rates, the breaking system is to increase interest rates, you'll simply increase taxes to try and cool down economies that have too much cash in it, and that people will be paid to behave like battery hens and live at home and maybe do some community service while more and more of work is going to be consumed by artificial intelligence and robotics. That's the vision of Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum, by the way. That's not just me estimating it. You know, I mean, he's a very great enthusiast about the link between the human biology and robotics, you know, that we'll be chipped and hacked and all of that kind of good stuff ahead of us. I mean, it's real dystopian stuff, but it's been planned. I mean, that's the point. Like, this isn't sci-fi. It's planned.
People need
to see it.
He's 82, that man. And I imagine him stroking that white cat, as in one of those Bond films. I can't remember who the character was. But Lindy, don't
make the mistake of thinking that this is the agenda of a single individual
Yeah.
I mean, this has been going on for a decade. It's long term. It's long in the planning. It's highly resourced. Go onto the website. You will see. You go into this big circular pie chart. You can click and you can go deeper and deeper and deeper into the planning into the plans and planning. And that's being pushed down into national governments as the way it should be done. And if you follow what's being said at the IMF, it's mirroring it. It's mirroring part of the agenda. And the same with Lagarde, who's gone in as head of the ECB.
Yeah.
She's now talking about digital currency, the euro, cyber euro. So it's all parts, all beginning to click into place. Along comes COVID-19. We all imprison ourselves in our homes. We plug in and listen to Pravda every day, RTE, producing its scary numbers with leaks from the establishment to the Irish Times in the afternoon that are published as speculative pieces the next day. That's then reported, as it says in the newspapers, between 6 and 8 in the morning those decisions are made. And that sets the national news agenda for the day. They scare the shit out of everybody to imprison themselves at home. And you might say, well, are they doing that out of malintent? No, they're doing it because they themselves are frightened about what's going on and not standing back and maybe looking at alternatives. And I think when the dust settles and all this and we look back, there's going to be a big inquiry into the type of decisions that were made at the time and what the motivations were. But certainly for me, I grew up in a time, you know, in Cork, we had a single channel. It was black and white. And the odd time on a Saturday night, you'd have a Hammer horror movie and broadcast. And the main scene usually ended in the graveyard, you know, with the smoke coming in. And that's when the vampires would come out, you know, with the and scare you. So that was the Hammer horror. And I just gave up watching it. I mean, all George Lee and Bowers were short with the makeup and the teeth, and it was clearly designed that way to keep people really frightened about what's going on, keep hitting them with the statistics, and that's been done with great success.
But why on earth?
If you want to understand what's going on, you've got to try and plug your head out of the state machine.
But what I really don't understand is the why. I mean, why this is a virus that the death rates speak for themselves. There's nothing unusual about our death rates in this country. Why have they terrified people like elderly women where I live, jumping out onto the road and, you know, under cars when I run past? I mean, the very fact that I'm running implies that I'm actually a fairly healthy horse. You know, so, but they literally have this look of terror. I mean, when I say to people that I've never once worn a mask, which I haven't, they look at me in astonishment. And I just say, I kind of say, well, I'm allergic. I don't add, well, I'm allergic to stupid, actually. But that's what I am allergic to, because I see no rational reason for it. The point of my raving is why? Why is there this need to terrorize us? I don't get it.
I mean, it started with the WHO declaring a pandemic when it wasn't really a pandemic,
by the
classical definition of a pandemic, you know, which used to be both the infection rate and the mortality rate. And then they did away with the mortality rate. It used to be an excess of mortality. Then they focused solely on the infection, you know. And so it starts with those bureaucrats, and that's a very corrupt organization, and it's been proven to be corrupt, particularly in recent years, you know, and in terms of it's funded by Big Pharma. There's massive conflicts of interest, left, right and center, and Bill Gates with all his conflicts of interest as well. Tedros himself is borderline terrorist out of Ethiopia, you know. So there's so many questions there. But then our guys, Tony Houlihan in Enfit, and there's issues with his background as well. He should not be in that position. He should have been made to resign years ago. You know, it's outrageous that he's still in that position. And the cervical check scandal as well, you know. So these guys just defer to you mentioned SAGE, they defer to WHO and SAGE, and they're not doing their own research because they can just blame the global bureaucracy has said this, you know. And then the George Lee and these people defer to these health bureaucrats. And I think also they're looking at the BBC and the CNN, and there's a lot. It's massive groupthink on a scale. It's very much akin to the property bubble that we had in Ireland, and indeed globally. There was a massive bubble in 2007, 2008, and very few people asked any questions about it whatsoever. You know, and those 40, 50, 60 page property supplements, and everybody bought into that narrative. There's only a tiny, tiny minority of people who are asking questions about it. And it's the same today. But the emperor's no clothes. The narrative is so it's lies upon lies upon lies. It's just a tissue of lies, and it can be exposed very, very, very quickly. But one thing, I just in terms of what Eddie said, he's absolutely right. There's been oligarchs throughout history, and now we have massive oligarchs. And it's funny, the CNN and the BBCs and the RTs, they talk about the Russian oligarchs, you know, and they're these evil oligarchs in Russia, you know, and they support Putin. It's like, can we not look at the own oligarchs here who are in Davos with this Klaus Schwab neo-fascist type, you know? Because we are heading in fascism is basically when the state and the corporations get together and they work together hand in glove against the interests of the small, medium enterprises. There's a few select corporations who do very well, but the majority of the people and the businesses do not do very well, you know? So the other point that Eddie made that's very important is this thing of the move to the DCBC. So digital central bank currencies. So we're going to move to not even paper. At least if you had euros, you could take your few 50 euro notes out and you could put them into a safety deposit box or put them under the mattresses, as Irish people used to do. People used to sneer at these Irish people who put money under mattresses. They're actually quite prudent, you know, given how our banks have turned out to be. So now you won't be able to do that. You're going to be completely dependent on not even your bank, your central bank, who will issue the currency directly into your account. And these guys, these oligarchs, look at China as a model. They love communist China, and they love the social credit score. They love the power that the Chinese elites have over the 1.3 billion people, the masses, because they're scared of the masses. They're very scared of the masses. They want to control us, ultimately. And this whole scandemic is about, it's about data, it's about profit, and it's about control. That's the three things that's going on.
There's one thing, I don't know, Eddie, if either of you have read a book called Bullshit Jobs by David Graeber, which anyone who knows me knows I keep quoting it. It's a silly title for a very serious book. And what it's arguing is a bit what we're saying. But I know from my involvement in voluntary work as a coach and so on, the layers of absolute bullshit you have to go through. And what I've realised is that the people who are getting ahead now, when I'm looking at the younger people now who are coming into my sport of athletics and possibly in companies and everything, the ones that are getting ahead are the people who actually enjoy ticking boxes. Mm. Whereas I just, like, I'll give you an example. I'm taking up your time, but I'm going to say this. In January, I had to get Garda vetted twice. And I lost a little list of where I've lived every year since my day of birth, which is quite a lot of places in several countries. And I couldn't find it. So I started making it up as best I could. And then I thought, well, there's a 3-year period where I was in several flats in the Dublin area. Couldn't remember. So I wrote down several flats in the Dublin area. Now, I'd been vetted since it started. I can't remember how long ago. They know bloody well I'm not an arch criminal. And it was sent back. I was turned down. So I put in the family address. I just told a lie. So they wouldn't accept me when I told the truth. They did accept me when I told the lie. And I've been waiting for something like this to happen because I think that there's all of these people micromanaging our lives. And I could get very rude here, but I am beginning to think that it's all that layer of unnecessary employment that they're sitting around in their office just trying to think of ways to occupy their time. And they come up with stupid things that we get onto the risk averse thing that just make us, you know, we can't do anything now with having ticked a whole load of boxes somewhere or other. Sorry, that's my rant for today. So do you agree with me?
Yes.
This is all supported by studies. I mean, you're just observing it quite naturally and instinctively as you look around. But bureaucracies, the whole function of this of the organization that runs states, let's call it the deep state, I don't mean in the American sense, I mean in the Irish sense, its function in all countries is of the organism is to survive and thrive.
Perpetuate
and the way bureaucracies do that is to just get bigger. If you want to understand that, you just watch episodes of Yes Minister, and you'll see you can laugh while you learn. But it's true, and that's what happens here. You've asked there earlier on, Lindy, a very, very interesting question. You know, why are we listening to this? Why is this happening? Well, the same mentality that that is driving all this data at us over the last 12 months. Oops, I think I'm gone there, am I? Anyway, the same. I don't know if you can hear me there.
Carry on,
I'm back there. So the same mentality that has driven this over the last 12 months is the same thinking that pushed the Children's Hospital into the James's site.
Yeah.
Giving us the most expensive hospital in the world and anything that goes with that. And we all sat back and looked at it. And that's the problem. We looked at the, you know, how can you radicalize a moderate population? How do you do it? The answer is by propaganda, by continuously pressing the same message. It's how the German society was radically transformed in the 20s and 30s, and how a large part of American society was radically transformed over the last presidency. And here we are wondering, you know, how is this happening in Ireland? And it's the same tools are being used. I can tell you that at the start of all of this, you know, RT presenters would have been given their instructions. The state, we were in a state of emergency. So, I mean, if you're plugging into RT, I'm not just picking on them. If you're plugging in conventional media that plug into RT, it is a nexus. You know, you're not getting news. You're getting information management during what they regard as almost like a time of war. And it's very, very difficult in that. I mean, Mark makes an interesting point about the property bubble. I remember at the time talking about property prices. And it was like standing in front of a herd of buffalo coming at you in the middle of a desert, and your sign is up saying this water is poisoned. You have no hope. They'll just trample you to get at the water. And that's where we are when you look at those people who are trying to stop you running down the road without a mask, Lindy. You know, they don't realize it, but they've been radicalized by the same blizzard of propaganda over the last 12 months. And behind the scenes, there are scientists pulling their hair out, leading medical people, trying to point out the stuff that I'm reading. I'm no medical expert about the nature of the events that turn up in hospitals coming from obesity and coming from diabetes and those type of illnesses really are the major part of the problem. And this could have been done in a far more surgical and targeted way. But we are where we are. And once you get political capital and medical, and I mean medical politics as well, capital behind these events, it's very hard to stop them until it's all over. And then we'll have the reviews and inquiries and looking back to learn our lessons. But really, the way we've managed this has been, I think, in hindsight, when all the dust is settled and all the historical results are in, will have been deemed to have been an unmitigated economic catastrophe that that was avoidable had it been done differently.
Well, but the other big question is, why have our democratic structures become so eroded? And since they have, as we know, is there any solution? What can we do? I mean, I don't bother voting anymore, I have to say. There's no point.
Mark, do you mind if I just take that one an observation? Because I deal a lot with the media. A deeply worrying aspect of this in Ireland and in other countries, but especially in Ireland, is that the Irish conventional media, journalism, has been enormously weakened. Mm-hmm. It has been hollowed out over the last decade.
We were talking about that before the show,
Newspapers are working on fumes. Yeah. Editors are working 50, 60, 70 hours a week trying to get newspapers out and journalism done. The journalists themselves, including our best investigative journalists who I deal with regularly, so the actual energy isn't there from the from, you know, very important part of democracy, that you've got independent journalists that are challenging the establishment, the status quo. That's gone. It's not there. And I mean, if you look beyond RTE, for example, last year, it was quite clear that News Talk was being softened. It was turned from a news organization to a magazine organization. With a lot of people ringing into programs talking about their feelings, which is fine, very entertaining, but it wasn't hard news. And that was softened because Dennis O'Brien was required to sell News Talk as part of his restructuring. So they walked off the pitch just at the wrong moment. So therefore, where was the voice? The national news agenda is set in RT in the morning before Morning Ireland starts. That drives it throughout the day. So we had the ideal way of getting a homogenous, herd-like reaction from the Irish, completely absent, independent, strong-willed, strong-minded journalists with the capacity and resources to properly investigate all the issues that you're talking about. It just hasn't happened in the mainstream, and these type of discussions have been thrown to the sidelines. So, and the people who are doing them are labelled nutcases and conspiracy theories.
So what do we do? I mean, we're kind of slightly running out of time now, but...
Well, we do. Your next guest, the man down in Cork, fair play to him, who organised that protest in Cork. We need to start standing up and speaking the truth. The media has silenced us, as Eddie has said. They try to make us out that we're total headbangers and conspiracy theorists, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot more people share our view than we realise. And I think it could be 25, 30, 35% of the population have views akin to us. But the media has made out that everybody's on the same page. We all agree it's a terrible virus. And they've, in effect, programmed people with fear. That's what they've done, you know. It's mass psychosis. It's, you know, extraordinary popular delusions. There's a great book, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and Madness of Crowds. And we just, throughout history, we've lost a run of ourselves. And, you know, it gave rise to the likes of Hitler, obviously, you know. So we're in one of these periods of time when it's mass psychosis, and you actually can't speak to these people, you know. But we have to stand up. We have to speak our truth. The protests that happened in Dublin and Cork are very important. They have to be peaceful. There will always be one or two idiots, or, you know, even 1% of the protesters might be violent. But the vast, vast majority in Dublin, and I was at that protest, 99.9% of them were actually peaceful. And the media completely ignored that. And then you have journalists and RTE calling for censorship. And they're actually going to big tech companies like Facebook and Twitter and telling, the journalists are telling tech to censor the people. It's absolutely outrageous stuff. Yeah, this is what's happening in RT at the weekend on the Brendan O'Connor show. So it's a very dangerous thing. When journalists start calling for censorship, it's very, very dangerous, you know. So what we can do in terms of vote, we need to, I think civil disobedience is important as well. Small businesses, farmers, they need to start, particularly in rural areas and small towns, they need to start open up their businesses and get on with things.
Are.
And
they
are doing it already, exactly. And you see it. I'm out on the roads quite a bit, and this traffic is out there. These people are not in their 5K, you know. People are getting on planes. They're going around the world. They're ignoring this because they know it's nonsense. It's literally nonsense. So we need to step up and say, enough is enough. We've had enough of this now. You've had your fun, lads. And it's time for people to stand up and say, we have the power. The people have the power. They always have the power. But they've taken the power away by programming people with fear. But we're greater than that. And we will overcome this as we've overcome. You look at the Irish history. This is just, it's a bad flu. It is quite a serious flu, absolutely. But you don't shut down and quarantine healthy people in their house and shut down your entire economy and destroy the mental health of your men, women and children. I mean, I heard of a family friend today who committed suicide. So this is what's going on out there. There's going to be an epidemic of suicides in the coming months and years, you know. And potentially more people will die of that than the, you know, the 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds who are dying of this virus, you know, and many people, they were going to die, and they've had good lives, most of them, hopefully, you know, and we should be celebrating their lives. We should be going to their funerals and talking about them and exchanging stories. Instead, they have these tragic, barbaric deaths. It's just absolutely outrageous, you know. We have to say stop, enough is enough, you know. And
Can I make Mark, if I could just make two quick points there. Firstly, suicide data isn't currently being collected because the coroner's offices are closed for the last, most of the last 12 months. So we don't have any data, and the data that's being collected by the CSO is a nonsense, and they know it because they're basically saying it themselves. The data isn't accurate. So our suicide statistics, for example, up until I think the third quarter last year, showed a fall, I think, of around 75%. And of course, that's because the coroner's offices inquiries are not happening. So you can park aside all of that. I can tell you that as we speak, there's a document beginning to float around from the TUI, the Teachers Union of Ireland, about their up-and-coming Congress. And one of the motions from, I think, Dublin C&C is that the schools shouldn't be reopened unless all of the children have vaccine passports.
Oh, God.
So when you're talking about where the fights are going to be, that's where, like sensible people within the TUI are going to have to fight that there. There's going to be all these micro challenges that are going to go on throughout the length and breadth of Irish society, where people are, as Mark said, people are going to have to stand up and put, you know, the tall poppy thing, put their head up above and say, sorry, we've had enough of this. Science, there's other science to this. I'm not listening to this any longer. I'm not a nutcase. What I'm saying is completely backed by medical and medical science, as well as economics and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, what will happen in reality in Ireland, we all know it, is that we'll be last to open up. We want to be the good boys of Europe, and we'll take our lead from when it's proven in other countries. And then we'll be clapping ourselves on the back on a job well done. Unfortunately, it could have been done an awful lot better.
I think I agree with you totally. And our problem here is that we're speaking to the converted, and I don't quite know how we speak to the unconverted. But leaving that aside and looking at the bigger picture, how do we stop the financial establishments in our country from being the bosses? They should be subservient to us rather than the other way around. Is there any way we can stop this?
You have to vote with your money is one thing, because as you said, a lot of people feel disenfranchised, and you look at all the political parties, the Greens, Sinn Féin, even the so-called opposition, sorry, the Greens are in government, Sinn Féin and Labour in opposition, they're nearly worse. They're pushing for this crazy zero COVID. It's like zero brain cells, you know. There's never been zero viruses ever. There's thousands of viruses in us, millions of viruses floating around the planet all the time, you know. So it's total, as Eddie said, it's not science-based. That's the thing. So, but how you can vote is actually by taking power back. You have to become independent and sovereign. You have to become your own sovereign, independent system. And the way you do that is you take some of your money, your hard-earned money, out of the system, and you put it into things that have value conferred by nature, that are finite and rare. So things like land and water and gold and silver. So gold and silver coins are a very condensed form of money, and they're very rare and they're finite, and people don't realize how rare they are, and that's why they've been money throughout history, you know. So that's a way to say we've had enough of your shenanigans, because in effect we're financing them by leaving our money in banks and by putting our money into stocks of somebody's corporations, you know. Our pension funds, it's going into Facebook and Apple and Netflix and Pfizer and all the rest of them. So we need to start putting money into land and grow our own food. And you know, we're blessed in this country. We're going to come through this because we're in a much better place than most countries in the world, you know, because we're blessed with good land, good water. But the corporations and these oligarchs, they have the science in that as well. You know, they're not backing down until we step up to them and say, we've had enough now. You've had your fun, lads. You've made enough money at our expense. It's now time for the people and communities to step up and take the power back. You know, we have the power. They tell us that we don't. And they, you know, the TINA, T-I-N-A, there is no alternative. There's always alternatives, and we need to create the alternatives. And that's what we're going to do in the coming months and years.
So because, yeah. I mean, my belief is that in 1924, when they dissolved, when Cosgrave or whoever it was at the time, dissolved the local councils, including Dublin Corporation, they eviscerated local democracy in this country, and we've never got it back.
We voted against Nice and Lisbon, and they're trying to concentrate power in the EU as well, you know. And I've been pro-Europe. Exactly. And that's what they're trying to do even more of now, you know. So, yeah.
The way you counteract the centralization of power in the imperial capital in Brussels is that you push power back down from the national chamber to local government.
How do we revive, I think that's the nub of it, how do we revive local government in this country?
Well, you need, unfortunately, Linda, you're going to need a new generation of thinking politicians that are elected to the national chamber, not on the basis of the shoe leather of going around and seeing voters as clients, and actually people that are prepared to talk about policy and change and leadership. But we do have a political establishment at the moment, unfortunately, that leads from behind. Catch the populist mood of the people and just keep pounding that message. So it's up to each individual one of us when we go into that vote with a little drop of ink and a piece of paper or a pencil on what box you tick. And it does come down to that moment.
To be honest, I've a dream of them giving an election and nobody turning up. I think that would be a huge wake-up call for them. But I know with local councils, one of the things, we're going to have to wrap up in a minute, but one of the things I've noticed in local committees and things that you and I, Eddie, were probably the oldest people here, that we went to meetings. I'm definitely the oldest, but what I've noticed in my own local community is that you go to meetings, we've been involved in sporting groups, we've been involved in unions and so on. We know how to conduct a meeting. We know about agendas, order, whatever, all that kind of stuff. And I noticed when some young people tried to set up a local community group in my area, they didn't know how to conduct a meeting.
Mm.
So I think we need to, there's more than just that people have to step up. People have to know what to do when they do step up, surely. I don't know what it's like down in County Kildare. It might be better. Seriously.
Well, I mean, I can tell you, I mean, I don't really hold to a lot of the criticism of the millennial population. I think that the young people that are coming through are highly educated, well able to think, not as well organised yet as they will be because they're young,
yeah.
But that will change with responsibility and so on. So there's deep change coming, and, you know, we do have a highly educated population, well capable of thinking for itself. But the way you deal with propaganda is you have to call out the propagandists. You have to be prepared to stand up and say, sorry, that's not news. That's not news you've been feeding me every night for the last year. Your job has been to scare the shit out of me, and I'm not taking it anymore.
That's exactly what they've done. Yeah, it is propaganda, in effect, yeah.
Well,
and they program people with fear. They brainwash them, in effect, you know. And they have the cheek to then project and invert it and make out that we're brainwashed when the opposite is the truth, you know. But ultimately, I think voting is important. It's part of it, particularly getting that grassroots, the communities, the local elections, local democracy. But we have to be very careful as well. A lot of these machines, this digital thing that we're moving towards and the feudal technocratic elites, these machines will be rigged. So you have to be very careful, you know. And I think there is something to be said for a paper ballot, ultimately, you know. And that way you might get some real democracy. But ultimately, you know, politics is a part of the solution. Economics is part of the solution. Our own psychology, working our own psychology and our spirituality as well. I do think to transcend this, it's much bigger than politics, you know, because there's so much fear out there. People are brainwashed. We need to go back into our hearts. And we actually need to forgive these people. It's outrageous what they're doing, but we have to forgive them. A lot of them are psychos. We have to acknowledge what they are. But then you have to forgive them. But then you have to put them on trial. You have to put them away for life. And then we have to get, you know, rebuild again. But not this crazy Build Back Better that they're trying to create of this sort of corporate dystopian utopia, like some hybrid Chinese communist fascist type of thing. We have to build, we need to actually get clear on the vision, what we really want to be as a society in 20, 30 years. We create our own vision, not their vision, and then we work towards that. And unless we start having that conversation, you know, then we live into their vision, which is quite dystopian, obviously.
Well, I think we have a job because the education system is a bit weird as well. But I'm with Eddie. I totally agree that fortunately when you're involved in sport, you are involved with younger people, and some of the young people I know are absolutely wonderful. And I would also recommend to everyone to start growing potatoes in their backyard and carrots and onions and the rest of it. And let's get ready for for whatever that something like one of those horror films you were watching, Eddie, when you were a young lad.
I know, I mean, I didn't want to make it sound like, you know, it's Armageddon. I mean, it's high inflation and all of that, and we go down the middle of the road. But, like, at the end of the day, I think the message for is to start thinking for yourself. Go and do the research. Don't be listening to me or to Mark or to anybody else. Go look for yourself. Find, you know, you'll come to your own beliefs just by looking at the facts. Open your mind. Stop just taking the data feed and start thinking for yourself. You're going to get quite surprised by what you find when you go and you do the reading.
Plurality of opinion. And that's what the journalists should be doing. They should be giving us both sides of the debate, and that's what forums like this are doing.
The good news is that we have got a request to have this discussion again or have more, but we're going to have to stop here now. But I think we've plenty to think about. Exactly that I would say to people, to go off and read a lot. I mean, there's plenty of books. I don't watch television, I don't listen to the radio apart from music. So I've been immune to all this propaganda, so it kind of took me by surprise that people weren't thinking for themselves. And among my own family and friends, they just think I've completely lost it. You know, maybe I have, folks. Maybe I have. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank Mark and Eddie, and with luck, we will get back to this if we have the demand for it, of course.
Thank you.
And we will now catch up with Diarmaid. It's Diarmaid, isn't it? From Cork, is somewhere there. So to find out exactly what happened in Cork last Sunday. Are you there, Diarmaid? Is he there?
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me, Dermot?
I'm here.
Yeah. So tell
I
us,
can hear you.
How did it all go on Sunday?
Saturday.
Was it Saturday? Sorry.
Yeah, it was, I think, a success beyond our own expectations, given the unprecedented level of security and blanket coverage to condemn anybody who wished to attend this rally. And so I think, I mean, numbers are varying, but we have concluded there was a minimum of 2,000 there, but people are estimating higher than that. I know mainstream media put in basically 500 or thereabouts, but any photographs will tell you that's completely nonsense. It was like, you know, of a generation, people might remember the hunger strikes in the 1980s. And I have not seen security on the street as heavy since that period. Towns around County Cork were circled and locked down. The city itself was locked down. And how people got in, and I know they had to defy numbers of checkpoints to get to where they got. And it's still a very successful rally. So the humour at the event, there wasn't a single ounce of trouble. I know varying reports have said there were numbers of people arrested. None of them were arrested at the actual event. One man was an unfortunate busker, a fire-eating performer, who was bundled into a paddy wagon maybe at least 3/4 of an hour before anything began. So there was no trouble. We had to endure a helicopter sitting above us in the air non-stop and a drone flying around and an unbelievable presence of Gardaí, including plainclothes Gardaí, mixing with the crowd and photographing into people's faces and everything. It was unprecedented. But I think the very important thing about it is that it went ahead. It would have been a terrible defeat, I think, for a people's movement to have yielded to the bullying, including, you know, I myself had Gardaí at my front door during the week, senior Gardaí, threatening to arrest and take us away. You know, unbelievable intimidation took place to try to stop the event. So despite all that, Cork kept the flag flying and had a very peaceful and good-spirited manifestation of broad opposition to lockdown. And we very deliberately did not allow ourselves to be dragged into areas where there might be contention, you know, like we didn't. There were a lot of people at the event with masks on them. We said, very welcome, Fáilte-Róid. The crucial issue was end the lockdown and that the people of Ireland should know the truth about what is happening and what is the state of public health care, why and wherefore and so on. And universally, people don't believe they're being given the truth. And I'm hoping the success in Cork will give a boost to further events in Dublin and elsewhere. And I know at the event, even though it was organised on the initiative of the People's Convention, going forward, the request was, and that's in place now, an independent grouping of people, anti-Cork, anti-lockdown or whatever, there's no real name on it, will carry on, and there will be further initiatives in Cork until such time as the lockdown is removed. So we're very happy that we think we had a big success.
I think I was impressed that even the Irish Times didn't say anything particularly derogatory, which I found extraordinary. So, you know, well done, all of you down there. I think using the word rally is a really good word. We have to leave the P word out because that seems to be a red rag to the bull.
Yes, it is. And apparently, like we received advice during the week prior to it that, you know, there could be a legal importance to this.
Yeah.
If we're organising a protest, and we kind of changed all our wording, even though from weeks ago we said this is a public rally, but we said it is not a protest. We're organising, exercising our right to peaceful assembly and expression of our opinions on what is probably the crucial issue in Ireland today, the most issue of most concern to people, and whether they're for lockdowns or against lockdowns. It is high on everybody's agenda. So, like, there's a clear legal basis for us holding these assemblies. And in fact, it's an outrage that such state security and blanket media coverage would be against the exercise of those rights. So one of the questions we posed at the rally was, well, look, if they believe that we shouldn't be doing this and we've no right to be there and so on, should we then organise a public tearing up of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? I mean, either these rights have importance or they don't have importance. And if they do, they should not be toyed with, especially by a Taoiseach or Taoiseach, both of whom said that we should be stopped. It's, you know, we're moving into a very bad place when national leaders and local leaders and so on can have these views. And I think it's hard to criticise the event on Saturday, because had there been a very small number turn up, you know, we'd have been hit with the usual propaganda. No one wants to listen to you and so on. But the numbers attending emphatically reject all of that, that we're a kind of a factional grouping or something off on the edge. We're not. There's a main body of opinion in the public that wants to end the lockdowns. And I believe from the spirit of the event last Saturday in Cork, this is going to grow. And I know my own phone has been hopping like non-stop. I can't answer all the calls since the event, even knowing what's the next step. And I know there's going to be quite an exodus from Cork to Dublin on St. Patrick's Day. So to try to make, there'll be no competing event in Cork that day because somebody wants to get to Dublin and back roads are being checked out to try and get there. But no, we're very happy after a very anxious time to put us away that this basic idea of people asserting their opposition has succeeded. And we know if we keep this up, we will turn back the government's policy. And we've been through all this a number of times, but more recently, I suppose, with the water charges. The people's growing movement is what stopped that. Nothing else, really. And we can do this. And some of the things you were mentioning earlier on about, you know, young people not knowing and so on. I mean, what you're doing yourselves, we need to develop people's media to inform the people. Like we have a thing here in Cork called the People's Paper, which we give out a couple of thousand of every month. But there's lots of different forms of media. So we have to compete with the mainstream media because nobody has confidence in it. And if we can do this in a professional way and get, without being dragged down avenues that are dead ends, deal with the high principles that are there, you know. And I think, one of the other things we did on Saturday in Cork as part of the organising basis, we asked that political parties, you know, not use it and not promote themselves on the day. And that was respected, so far as I know. I know a lot of political elements were there, and that's fine, but it wasn't to be used to promote any parties because people have a resistance to that as well. They don't want to be used as cannon fodder in somebody else's cause. And so I think it augurs well. So I'm looking forward to seeing a massive display in Dublin on next week and further events in Cork and elsewhere.
Great. Thank you, Dermot. Yeah, well, the good news, of course, is that Tracy is taking a court case against exactly what you're talking about, against the erosion of our rights. So fingers crossed it'll work out. And she's doing that from, she was funded by one of those GoFundMe things or whatever you call them. So people want this clarified. What?
People power again.
People power. So as Dermot was saying there, maybe this will be the start of some form of local democracy. Maybe we can build on this so we can take some good news from tonight. And at that point, we really are going to have to let you all go home, or us go home. So don't forget that the Healthy Debate is brought to you by brought to you by a small group of volunteers. And we know who they all are now. There's Stephen, there's Sarah, who's keeping very quiet there, Danny, Peter on the technical things, and Kieran Cormack, who are becoming rapidly indispensable, our students from Ballyfermot. If you'd like to support what we're doing, and we're doing exactly what Dermot said, this is local journalism, and if anybody wants me to write for any small newsletters, just ask is all I can say. I'm a journalist myself to my backbone, and I'm deeply offended by what's happening. But if you want to finance the Irish Inquiry, there is a donations page. You don't have to pay, but if you do have a few bob to spare, it would help greatly, because our facilities, we do have to pay for them. So we leave you with that, and thank you to our guests tonight, to Mark, to Eddie, and to Dermot there at the end. And we'll see you again next week. Good night.
Thank you.